Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of Money Talk. I'm Neil Kreisel, and Diane Duva and I are your hosts every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 11, and on Saturdays at 6. We're brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending, whose highly trained and experienced team takes great pride in helping people with home financing, offering competitive rates and a wide array of loan programs. And American Riviera Bank, smart banking to smart people. In Santa Barbara at Figueroa and Anacapa Streets and in Montecito's Upper Village, and Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm in Santa Barbara, providing its clients with the personal care and attention of a small independent firm, coupled with the vast resources of a major financial institution.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
I'm good. The weekend was terrific.
Weekends are always terrific. Although for you, does it really have a difference?
It is, because I don't know when the weekend is. In fact, I don't like weekends because
there's a little more traffic out there for you.
There's more people competing for the recreational facilities of this community.
Yes.
So I prefer the week during the week because...
That makes sense. A good retirement perspective.
By the way, while I have you here, do we have a guest today?
We do. We are thrilled to have in studio with us Priscilla Liang, who is a professor of business and economics and the dean of the MBA program at CSUCI.
I'm not the dean.
You're not the dean?
Yeah.
Well,
no.
I'm sorry then. Well, we're going to promote you.
All right. Sounds great.
For the purpose of this show, you're the dean.
Whoever that is, we'll just get into the curb.
Right. So, in fact, because...
Well, welcome, nonetheless.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We do a lot of promotions on this show when we get the title wrong.
And sometimes we call Neil Kreisel for president. So,
you're right.
You never know what you're going to get here.
Well, so... the choice of articles sometimes is a natural selection process, and this is just sort of ironic. But today, I got an email from the CFA Institute with a new article that was written by Eugene Fama, and Eugene Fama is a University of Chicago distinguished professor who is so old.
He's also a Nobel Economic Prize winner as well.
But to the point of being old, when I took my MBA, I read his material. That's how old he is. Anyway.
I've met him in person, and in fact, he's not that old.
Really? He must have been very young when he was. He must be smart.
Yes, he is. And he's the academic behind Dimensional Fund Advisors, the outfit down in Santa Monica.
Right. So here's the thing. I thought this would be an interesting, even though it's very esoteric, an interesting article to bring in given who we have as a guest today. So the article, which just came out today, and his co-author talk about how high volatility is something that most investors underestimate. And what he does is he takes a look at the risk premiums between 1 month and all the way out to 30 years. And he did this with, the usual academic detail with monthly returns for over 100,000 possible outcomes. And what he found is that there is a large negative effect with volatility, where volatility can produce negative risk premiums, and it is something that people should be aware of. Now, the reason I brought this article in is because...
You wanted everyone to know that you're on the CFA email distribution list.
The CFA program was something that has no value to me anymore, although I am a CFA. And the reason I continue to get it is that if I'm retired, I get free membership.
Oh.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes.
So, but here's the thing, and this is sort of my beef with a lot of academics, is that when he goes to the next paragraph, he talks about how he did this, and he looked at the standard deviation of monthly premiums and blah, blah, blah. Well, standard deviation is a construct that uses normal distribution as a predicate to make it make sense. And what I found to be a very a real question in the academic community is the fact that no one talks about black swan. No one talks about this, I think, very relevant discussion about how we don't live in a normally distributed world, and how when you look at anything like standard deviation or variance that relies on the assumption of a normally distributed world, you are possibly getting yourself into a position where you're being led down the garden path. And
well, because the reality is that markets aren't always efficient, and that is, you know, the market, the efficient frontier, and how that works. If you believe that that works all the time, the black swan events will really get you.
And that was Fama's work on the efficient market theory. Mm-hmm. But the issue here is that, and I don't know whether it's changed, but I remember I looked at textbooks, and after Taleb wrote Black Swan, if you look at the index of every textbook, there wasn't one mention of Black Swan. There wasn't one mention of Parisian distribution, you know, where, you know, you have these big humps at the end. There was this, you know, total lack of consideration for the idea that everything that we use today in investing, you know, whether it's Sharpe, whether it's Traynor, whether it's just plain old standard deviation, if you believe that we don't live in a normally distributed world, then you're really fooling yourself and you're using a tool that really doesn't have any relevance. And the reason I'm bringing this up on a radio station that probably doesn't have that many listeners who are in the academic finance community is because if you go to an investment advisor, they tend to give you certain tools. And one of them is looking at risk by looking at standard deviation or looking at beta, which is basically what beta is. And people feel comfortable if they have, quote unquote, a low beta stock. And I think that does a disservice to people when they think that just simply because there's a low beta, they're not taking as much risk as they would take otherwise.
Well, but at the same time, it's what you have to measure portfolios, Neil. So if, you know, part of it is you have to use the tools that are available. And the academic tools are useful in creating portfolios. And yes, it doesn't protect you against black swan events, but it is the tools that you have that to make the best decision with the information that you have.
So in 1880, it was okay to do bleeding for diseases with a leech because we didn't have anything else. So we should...
Well, it was the only thing available,
okay.
So yeah.
So it didn't work, though. But the point is, I'm saying that the reality is that I'm... In fact, this leads me to my next article.
Fabulous.
And this article... Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
Actually, your topic was just very interesting. So may I chip in for
Please
a minute?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I study behavior finance a little bit. So Eugene Fama, you mentioned, he is the backbone of traditional finance. So from my profession in my classroom, all our textbook is based on traditional finance, such as you're talking about risk and return always hand in hand. And when we talk about measured standard deviation beta, all that, assume you have normal distribution. I do a lot of research in emerging market finance, and then their data never was normally distributed, put it that way. So... Excuse me. So I agree with Diane that there are a lot of those tools actually is very useful to help our investor to create their portfolio. But on the other side, we also need to take a look at, well, who is this investor? What is their behavior aspect? What their age? What their risk tolerance? And all these actually imply to the field of behavior finance, which you... sort of a combine the psychological theory and behavior theory and together with the traditional finance theory to study how we make financial decisions.
That's so, a great point, because that's exactly what you do when people come to see you. Mm-hmm. You have the traditional finance method that mm-hmm. you use as a baseline.
Yeah.
And then you talk to them about their feelings and perceptions and,
exactly.
and how they view money mm-hmm. and how they view markets.
Yeah.
And that really plays into what their asset allocation should be mm-hmm. or how much risk are they comfortable with
mm-hmm. yeah.
and how much means do they have to take such risk.
Yeah. We're all humans. We behave differently. And in many ways, behavior finance explain black swan, bubbles, and contagious effect in global financial market, and explain why we buy high and sell low.
In fact, I'll quickly read you the headline, the headlines of this article this week in the Wall Street Journal by your favorite author, Jason Swig. He said, here are the things, it's called the cocky voice in your head is wrong. Behavioral economics teaches us that people are overconfident. They believe they know more than they do or assume their knowledge is more precise than it is.
Mm-hmm.
Confirmation bias leads most people to seek out evidence supporting what they already believe. And that's true not only in finance, it's true in politics too. You tend to want to get reinforced.
Absolutely.
Behavioral economics shows that people are predictably bad at estimating probabilities. They tend to overestimate the likelihood of a rare event and underestimate the frequency of common events. And they exhibit what's called bias blind spot, or the tendency to see clearly that the other people's behavior isn't optimal by remaining oblivious to their own shortcomings. And so I agree that I think behavioral investing and behavioral science study is really important to really understand.
Yeah, what's interesting is when you look at the behavioral finance, you have a behavioral gap of about 6% of what, you know, if the S&P 500 gives you an 8.2% rate of return, the average investor gets like 2.6. You know, they have a different return or a different outcome than if they had just stayed invested in whatever the investment would be.
You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending. Since 1988, a mortgage banker and direct lender that believes in providing in-depth loan consulting to its customers in a personalized and honest manner.
Hi, Neil. We have in studio with us today Priscilla Liang, a professor of business and economics at CSU Channel Islands in the MBA program. Thanks so much for being here with us, Priscilla.
Well, thank you for having me.
So before the break, we were talking about behavioral. Well, first, before we jump in, let's find out a little bit about you. So how did you become a professor of economics, and what is your background?
First of all, I'm an immigrant. I came to the United States from China when I was 25. So I finished my undergrad in China, worked for a few years in China, and then worked for a few years in the United States. And finally, after I finished my MBA, I taught as a part-time lecturer for a few years. And I realized it's a really rewarding career for me. And I make me so happy when I see the sparkle in student eyes when they finally, you know, able to solve something, or when I write them a recommendation letter, they got a job, and make me very, very proud. So in my culture, teaching is a very highly respected profession. We say a teacher for a day is a father for a lifetime. So after I taught for a few years, I realized this is really my calling. So I decided I went back to school, at a middle of my, beginning of my age 30s, and finished my doctoral education and, you know, became academia formally.
Wow. So you immigrated over when you were 25. Now, mm-hmm. Did your family come with you, or?
No, I came here by myself. Actually, my company sent me here. So I work for one of their subsidiary here in LA.
So how come I still have my New York accent and you don't have a Chinese accent? How did you do it?
I know I was shocked when you said 25. You really do not have much of an accent at all.
Actually, I never formally learned English. I learned Japanese when I was in college, because at the time I really, I'm not saying dislike, but just English is just so foreign to me. So, yeah.
Well, you did very well.
I think people from northern part of China, it's a little bit easier pronunciation-wise, because we have the sound of er, versus a lot of people from southern China, they don't have that sound, so their English is a bit of pronunciation's a bit tough or rough in a sense.
And so, really, what even made you want to take on the class and teach a class as an adjunct or a teacher, you know, as an adjunct teacher or lecturer when you were working and in corporate America, it sounded like?
Well, I feel like I always I want to share, and I want to help people. So I think teaching has a little bit in me. And also, I mentioned earlier, teaching is a highly, highly respected profession. So when I had that opportunity, so Cal State San Bernardino was the first school that gave me that opportunity. And then, so I jumped right on. And of course, in the beginning, my English was an issue, but back then, still issue sometimes. So it took me a while to get used to facing students, how to communicate them with them, and how to break down. I teach finance, so break down those complicated finance theory and models into a language that I feel like if I can understand it, my student can understand it. And I realized they actually really like my style of teaching. So that gave me a bit more confidence. So really, it's a learning process, but I'm really glad I'm here.
There's an article in last week's New York Times about what it takes to be a good teacher. And the author gives an example that Albert Einstein was the worst teacher. No one liked him. They couldn't understand him, and and the author has a theory that if you are too smart and if you had too easy a time learning, it may be more difficult for you to relate to students. And so, you know, you're saying in the beginning, you know, had a language issue. That probably makes for a better teacher because you have to think about how to communicate, which is a real skill that a lot of teachers don't have.
Exactly. Also, I think what to make a better teacher, especially in business, also you need to have sort of a practical experience, industrial experience as well.
And what did you do? What was the company that transferred you here? What did they do?
I worked for a real estate developer, actually one of the largest real estate developers in China because it's a state-owned enterprise when I was in China. And here in the United States, I mainly was in international business. But I played around in the financial market a little bit when I was in China as well.
And so given that you have had experience at other academic institutions, what would you say makes Channel Islands unique?
Well, good question. I taught at Cal State San Bernardino, Cal Poly Pomona, also Azusa Pacific University. So compared to the other large CSU, Cal State Universities, Cal State Channel Island is the newest member. So it's a small, it has potential for growth, a lot of potential for growth, and a very innovative. But what struck me most is after I taught at Cal State Channel Island, I decided this is really my school, is a student-centered mission and also interdisciplinary approach to education, which I think is very important. I think about a lot of school will say, okay, we're student-centered, or we have multidisciplinary approach, but at Channel Island, really, we're not just, it's not a slogan. It's how you design a curriculum, how you train your teacher to teach that courses, how you get the feedback from student. It's every bit sort of in our daily event, daily activity.
And so Channel Islands has a program here in Santa Barbara. Can you share with us a little bit about the differences between the program on campus versus here and how it all works? If somebody who's listening is thinking, oh, I would like to get an MBA.
Well, we have our main campus in Camarillo, but we serve Ventura County, Santa Barbara County area as well. So as one of the Cal State University, we're here to serve the local community. So what we have here in Santa Barbara and Goleta area is we have a business completion program for undergrad student, and also we have MBA program. For our business completion program is for those students who are adult learners and they finish their first 2 years of college education either in community college or other universities, and then they start a junior and seniors of business education with us. So given that slow probably 2-3 hours away, and UCSB really don't have a business program. So we think we can really serve Santa Barbara area very well with this undergrad program. We also have our MBA program here, and I would say we have a really good top quality MBA student, and currently our MBA student are working professionals, which means they have at least 2 years managerial or supervisory experience, or even if they're analysts, that they have independent decision-making power or independent analytical skills. And so it's I'm really proud of those kiddos, and they're doing very well. And those students, actually, they even though they're in our satellite campus here in Santa Barbara, but they are our CSU CI student. They get the same degree as the main campus student, and they go to the main campus for their graduation ceremony. So they're every part of Cal State Chino Island.
And they have the same professors.
Well, they have the same professors. Thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, so, and you know, the thing that's really important is that the Santa Barbara community doesn't realize what a fantastic asset this is. And if you look at the ability to learn among people that have had some experience, which is what, you know, Harvard insists upon, because if you bring to the classroom some experience, it helps everyone learn. And so by having this opportunity to be part of a group of people who actually have worked, it really increases the level of learning. You're listening to Money Talk on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
So to follow up on what we were talking about before the break, in terms of MBA program here in Santa Barbara, it's really the only local MBA program that exists. Other than that, you're driving down to L.A., and, you know, it was such a niche that was needed. About how long ago did you start the program here in Santa Barbara?
Santa Barbara, I would say we started to have our first batch of graduate student at 2011. And we have been here ever since. And we have, we're pretty selective of our students, so we have a small classroom. And I think we have several other MBA program offered here in Santa Barbara, but they're private institutions, and their cost is substantially higher than ours. And like Neil mentioned early on, our professors from main campus and also local Santa Barbara business leaders and those who have a substantial business experience in the local area also are part of faculty team. So we really offer very high quality of education here as well.
And one of the things about CSU in general, CSU Channel Islands in general, is that if you look at the cost of going versus UCSB, and UCSB is not an expensive school relative to the United States, it's a very small percentage of the cost. So what you have here is as a Santa Barbara resident, the opportunity to send your child to a first-class institution at significant savings. And the other thing about the school, given the demographics of Santa Barbara, is it's a Spanish, what's the word, leaning or something?
A Spanish serving institution. Yes, we are, actually.
And so it's really provides for an opportunity for, you know, everyone to get a first-class education.
So now let's talk a little bit. You described who the students are in the program, but do they skew younger in age still, or are there many adult learners, so, you know, people who are paying for it themselves as opposed to mom and dad footing the bill?
Oh, no. Those are, if we're talking about MBA, even our Santa Barbara Business Completion Program, those are adult learners. But when I mention adult learners, they're not in their, I would say, on average, our student MBA will be late 20s, early 30s. That's a typical student. And our student actually very diverse population. We have international students. We have a student that first generation college student. Since I interviewed most of them, so I still remember during the summer, we have, for example, this female student. She was a farm worker in Santa Maria. And now she works for Santa Barbara County Social Service, and she has a dream to be the chief for the division. So we want to, say, help those students to fulfill their dreams. And we also have a student that work for large companies, local company like Raytheon Deckers. But also we have, I would say, at least four students have interest in entrepreneurship. And they're either in the wine, local wine industry, real estate, and they want to pursue their own business. So very diverse the student population, but on average, I would say they're late 20s, mid 30s.
And on campus, those students in the program on campus, what are their age? Who are in the main campus?
About similar. Yeah, about similar. Those are because those are the students come in into their position mostly in the beginning of their management career, and then they want to learn more and they want to move up in their corporate ladder. And we also have a very, on campus, we have a very unique dual degree program. Is the student can get Master of Science in Biotechnology and MBA at the same time. So that's the one of only four in the country. And so these are, we serve, for example, we have Baxter, we have Amgen, we have a lot of students who are scientists, engineers, and come into our program because they were scientists by training in the STEM program for their undergrad. But then they became managers and they realized, hey, I need to learn some management, the leadership skills. So then they, it's a really great opportunity to for them to get a dual degree, master's at the same time.
So given your background of being from China and what's going on in the world right now in terms of the prospect of trade wars and tariffs, and what do you see that, how do you see that impacting not only the global economy, but also the U.S. economy in particular?
Well, great question. A trade war is an everyday topic nowadays, right? I would say, really look at what will be the outcome of this trade war. I think based on that love, I read some articles and listened to some discussions and literally put in the two lines as economic-wise, China will be at disadvantage because, for example, in 2017, China export $505 billion to U.S. and U.S. only export $130 billion. So with $375 billion of trade deficit, obviously China is almost out of weapon. So out of list of goods to be tariffed on. But also, I personally think that there's two other aspects we need to take into consideration. One is a political aspect. So I think President Xi will last longer than President Trump because Xi has a lifetime presidency. And also you need to take a look at how this trade war play into the long-term strategic plan of China in both of economic development, social development. But for the U.S. consumers and the U.S. economy, I think in a such integrated global economy that a trade war will hurt everybody. In the short term, we may see some job will go back to the United States. We may see wage will increase. But in the long term, these can be having opposite effect. And really, there's everything has a pros and cons of the same policy. So for example, if we put tariff on 25% tariff on the auto industry, auto imports, then from based on by 2017, more than 40% of automobiles sold in the United States are imported. And even for the automobile produced in the United States, one-third of the parts are imported. So basically, U.S. consumer will get hit by increasing in price, automobile increasing price, appliances, electronics, and a lot of. So will that hurt our economy in long term or short term? Really depends on a lot of factor into play. At this point, I really cannot tell, but I only can say trade war is not good.
Will China blink, or do you think they'll stand strong?
Well, very good question. I think mainly based on the last two things I mentioned. One is, will this raise to a point that the President Trump's can I say, arrogance and aggressiveness that were raised to the point of a national pride and national sentiment is a show off of power. If that's the case, then China will not. Another thing is China has been, after the first hit, 2007 global financial crisis, China realized it really needed to rely more on domestic consumption to drive their economic growth and less than export. And China actually has been taking a big stride on that position. So today, especially the $200 billion proposed tariff on China goods mostly are based on China's 2025 Made in China initiative. So those are based on a lot of value-added industries such as aerospace, information communication technology, robotic, auto. And those are really what China want to becoming stronger in that aspect. And that what is main backbone of China's economic structure. So with that in mind, if China felt like it will hurt their own strategic plan, they may cave in a little bit, but planning for the long term.
You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back. Money Talk, brought to you by American Riviera Bank, making your life easier with cutting-edge technology, mobile deposits, free use of every ATM machine in the country, and a level of service other banks can only dream about.
So before the break, we were talking about the trade war, the global trade war that's going on between U.S. and China. And, you know, you mentioned one point about politics, which I'd like to get to, but I also was speaking with some technology CTOs and how it's almost like moving a chess game. So most of their parts are made in China, but they do have a plant in Taiwan or a plant mm-hmm. in Malaysia.
Yes.
And so in essence, what they're doing is they're moving wherever parts were shipped to. Now the Chinese parts are going to Europe and the other parts are going to the U.S. or Europe and Canada and Mexico, everywhere else, whereas the Malaysian-made and Taiwanese-made parts are now being shipped to the U.S. Now, is that going to have actually an economic impact? Because I feel like that's just kind of moving checkers around a board in terms of, you know, how companies can be nimble and come to the, you know, here are the rules and then start playing by them in a different way.
I agree and disagree. In some sense, maybe it's a checker play. In the long term, you can always move your factory somewhere else. You can find a new supplier. But in the short term, or even in the long term, you still take a look at where is, you know, when we talk about globalization, you're talking about economy of scale. You're talking about what you're really good at it. So you're producing something, you're most efficient, you provide something low price and high quality. So that's where you're going to supply that part. And some other country will support. So it's a very highly integrated global supply chain. So in the future, are we going to move the part to someone else actually not very good at produce that part? So and in the short term, the damage could be devastating because we earlier mentioned about these Made in China 2025 initiative. All these goods actually is highly really have global supply chain issues. So we're talking about for example, communication technology. Could it be the phone, the screen of the phone made in South Korea or the chips made in Taiwan or Singapore? And these are all assemble somewhere else. So when we talk about trade war with China, say it's indirect trade war with Asia or Donald Trump has already have trade war with everybody anyway. So, but it will really indirectly impact Asian economy really severely.
But you know what John Maynard Keynes said? He said, if there's no short term, there's no long term. And I hope the leaders realize that while it may all work out in the long term, they could create an incredible amount of havoc.
Well, and so then that brings me to the point of, you know, you brought in the political side of things. Mm-hmm. And many people do think that our president is President Trump is creating this trade war so then he can solve it before the midterm elections. And what
do you think? Will he be able to solve it before midterm elections?
Well, I guess that's my question in terms of, you know, negotiating with the Chinese government, if that's going to be possible.
But short term, Trudeau, which is the one that he has to solve by September 30th, said today that he's not going to be bullied and that his principal issues that have been the stumbling block, he's not going to move on. Now, maybe he will, but his real problem today is Canada, not China. China can be delayed for a while.
Well, if a President Trump really is a strategic player, and he should, in my personal opinion, he should make alliances with the other country and have the same front to confront China with intellectual property rights issue, with the trade deficit issue. Unfortunately, he's starting war with everybody.
Right. He's not approaching it in a manner that actually could make some progress, because the intellectual property issue that we have with China is real, and it does cost the economy a lot of money in that. But what do you think about the trade war with not only China but, you know, with Europe? With, you know, it's hard to know where we're all going to net out on this, but with Canada in particular, with a deadline looming.
And on top of that, you know, getting rid of the Trans-Pacific Trade Pact, all it does is strengthen China's hand, because now countries in that area are thinking, maybe I should align myself with China. And that could have a long-term negative impact.
My understanding is a Trans-Pacific Partnership, China was not part of it.
Right.
Now, U.S. is out, China's in. So in some sense, I think maybe because the push from President Trump that Asia was actually trade-wise was pretty segregated in the past. Now we'll finally be able to unite it. And Asia itself is a $4 billion of a consumer market.
And couple that with the fact that, you know, the route, the reopening the old Silk routes into some major trading routes will only help Asia getting to Europe as well as Africa.
Yeah. So China will be able to get supplies such as agricultural product. And in the short term, of course, China will be, you know, get hit, such as the soybean. China imports more than 60% of the soybean. Right now, even say China goes towards Brazil, but Brazil will not able to have enough supply. So in the short term, China, economic-wise, China will get hit. But will China able to say, okay, I'm going to stick with it and continue this and drag it longer? Because Mr. Trump here facing, well, first of all, free press. And also, Mr. Trump faced a very strong lobbyist, and also midterm elections coming. And on the other side, President Xi has none of this.
Right. And also, President Xi has a positive demographic issue, whereas the U.S. has an aging population. And not that the Chinese don't, but the Chinese have, you know, Southeast Asia has something like 350 million emerging middle class with disposable income. And the growth is very measured and steady with a lifetime, with a life term. I'm not sure if we call him a president, but, you know, when you never get kicked out of office, it's easier to recover from mistakes.
Yeah, actually, I want to address that. I think that's a very good point. China's economic reform, economic development is every bit is top down, staged, planned out. China has, just like other socialist country, like Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, India today, has so-called five-year plan, or today is called a five-year guideline. In this five-year guideline, is plan out which industry need to be developed, more encouraged, and where the country want to go, how they want to. For example, if we say 15 years ago, China's consumption only 20 to 30% of GDP, but today that's almost half, 50% of a GDP. Of course, that's still far away from the United States, but China is moving away from export-driven economic growth, and it's really much, much more focused on domestic consumption, because take a look at 1.4 billion people. In the near future, 50% of them will be middle class. Just take a look at the tourists come to United States. And I have, our campus in Camarillo, the Camarillo outlet, the sign is in Chinese for
yes.
two to satisfy those Chinese customers. They come all the way to Camarillo Outlet Mall to shop. So we really, I hope this trade war will give us upper hand in actually capture this increasing consumer market instead of losing it.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point, because that's a real risk that we run, that, mm-hmm. The U.S. doesn't seem like a welcoming tourist destination. And that's not only for China, but really all of the world.
Oh, if the trade war continue on, the Chinese government can restrict and then can guide its tourists to go in somewhere else instead of the United States.
You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back with our final segment. Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
And so what I wanted to do, Priscilla, is circle back to the behavioral finance piece, because we started the segment with that, and then I didn't get a chance to ask you any questions. So what I wanted to know is, in the economics department at CSU Channel Islands, are you teaching behavioral finance in tandem with the traditional finance models?
Of course. In the past, I taught it as an interdisciplinary course. Behavioral finance by nature is interdisciplinary, so it's really cross the discipline between sociology, psychology, and finance together. And in the future, behavioral finance, and together with investment, with corporate finance, management, international finance, these will be our upper division option courses for our finance option students.
Because Richard Thaler mm-hmm. got the Nobel
yes.
Prize in
uh-huh.
economics
yes.
for just last year mm-hmm. for his
yes.
his work in behavioral finance.
Yeah, behavioral finance actually, in my opinion, has been there for a while, but really get recognized after several Nobel Prize winners in behavior economics and behavioral finance got awarded. So today, I would say just about every good finance program in the country, in the nation, behavioral finance is a must offer the finance course.
And what's so interesting is, if you look at any economics book from Keynes to Samuelson, mm-hmm. it always says, we're going to give you this theory, and it assumes a couple of things, that people act rationally, and then it goes on. Well, what's rational?
Even Keynes himself says the market can stay irrational longer than you can remain insolvent, right?
Right.
But so many economic theories that have gone down the drain after some testing is based upon a construct that's just not true. People don't act rationally. People act like people. And so you need to...
Humans aren't wired for rational.
I'm the only one of the few people. I am one of the few people that's pretty rational. And that's because I've had 25 years of therapy.
and unbiased, too. No bias going on.
And no bias. I'm one of the few people. Like they said in that article before, people
yes.
think everyone else is nuts but them.
Yes, absolutely. So as it's an interdisciplinary offering, this behavioral finance, do you find that... do you actually get a cross-section in each class from each of the disciplines of sociology, psychology, and economics?
In the future, when when this class become the finance option, will be just taught by our finance professors. But in the past, we were co-taught with finance and psychology.
And one of the things that the school does, which is really great, is that professors can get together with professors from another department. I had two guests on. One was an art teacher, and the other was a philosophy teacher. And they put together a photographic exhibit about living in Finland.
Oh.
Talk about interdisciplinary. It was pretty different. And it's the kind of thing that it would be very tough to do at a traditional university.
So currently in the MBA programs, are there any other interdisciplinary courses taught?
For MBA?
Yeah.
For example, this semester, I'm teaching business strategy. Actually, my focus will be economy and business strategy in emerging countries like China. So I started the course talking about business economy from China, take back into really from a historical and a cultural perspective. Anytime when you do business in another country, you have to understand its culture. You have to understand its history. So therefore, your business strategy started from your product localization, how you advertising, marketing your product, and even how to manage its human resources. It's every bit you need to understand the culture first.
And you know what? I think that's true for politics also. It would be helpful if our government understood the cultural aspects of the countries we're starting fights with.
On that, I totally agree with you.
On that note, Priscilla, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is fun.
And, you know, it's another of many reasons to take a look at CSU Channel Islands, particularly for those of us that live in Santa Barbara. You've been listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.